Cybersecurity specialist Jonathan Kamens worked at the United States Digital Service until Elon Musk's Department of Governmental Efficiency fired him. Jonathan had been assigned to help the Department of Veterans Affairs secure its digital infrastructure. VA.gov stores and processes huge amounts of veterans' personal information. Jonathan's first interview with DOGE proved to be his last.
So DOGE is trying to do three different things. I think it's important to lift this out of the weeds and to look high level at what the three things they're trying to do are. The first thing is grift, right? They're trying to steal money to benefit people like Elon Musk. You know, Elon Musk wants to rig how contracts are awarded by the government so he and Donald Trump can control who gets the contracts. And guess what? Funnily enough, a lot of those contracts are coincidentally going to go to Elon Musk's companies and the companies of his friends, right? So that's number one. Number two is they are trying to destroy the government. I'm just going to be frank here. Like, I'm not going to beat around the bush. I'm not going to equivocate. What Trump and Project 2025 are trying to do is destroy the federal government. You know, it was Grover Norquist who said many years ago that he wanted to shrink the government down to a size that was small enough that he could drown it in a bathtub. Like, these folks do not believe that there should be a federal government which constrains, you know, rich white Christian men in any substantive way, and therefore they are trying to destroy every aspect of the federal government which constrains them or their actions, which is most of the government, right? The whole, you know. And then the third thing they're trying to do is they're trying to amass all of the data that the federal government has on Americans in one place.
Welcome, everybody, to the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm one of your hosts, John Lebkoski, and that guy sitting over there, Scoop Sweeney, is my partner in crime. And our other co-host is Wendy Grossman. So this our guest, unfortunately, is in a three against one situation here, but we'll try to be completely
coordinated in our attacks.
Yeah, exactly. So, and our guest is Jonathan Kamens, who has decades of experience in information security, software engineering, and, you know, technical operations. And he was recently DOGED from his position as information security lead at the Department of Veteran Affairs. He had been working there via the United States Digital Service, and that's one thing we're going to talk about. But I think we're going to start out, and Wendy's going to take the lead here, and we're going to kind of go back in time. Wendy.
Yeah, I originally encountered Jonathan as the keeper of FAQs. People under 40 probably think that we've always had FAQs, and if they've thought about the history of the thing at all, they probably wonder a little bit how we distributed them when we had to write them on paper with quill pens. But they actually do have a date of invention. And, you know, it started on Usenet, which is basically Reddit without the graphics. And people had FAQs because people would come into the same news group and ask this, into a new news group and ask the same questions that had been asked thousands of times before. So people built these lists of answers. And Jonathan had kept the server on which all these things were stored. And then we sort of re-encountered each other on Mastodon last year, the year before. But maybe Jonathan, you could fill in some of the gap between being I think you were still a student when you were doing the FAQ stuff, and sort of how you landed at the digital service.
So I showed up at MIT a long time ago, 1987, and I was a smart-ass 17-year-old who thought I knew everything about everything and was smarter than everybody else about everything. It didn't take me long at MIT to realize that that was not the case. You get to MIT and you get to choose one of two things. You either decide you're going to be valedictorian at MIT just like you were in your high school, or you decide you made it to MIT and you don't have to be valedictorian anymore because you're at MIT. I chose the latter very quickly. I did not... Let's just say I learned more outside of my classes than in my classes when I was at MIT. Anyway, so I showed up at MIT and I was introduced to Usenet. And It was love at first sight to the extent that I spent many, many, many more hours than I should have on Usenet news groups answering questions. And I got sick of answering the same questions over and over again. So, like Wendy said, I set up a workstation at MIT, my personal work workstation, because I worked for the undergraduate computer system and we all had computers. So this is back in the days before network address translation. So every one of our computers was on the internet with a public IP address that anybody could get to from anywhere on the internet. And no one had ever heard of firewalls. And so therefore, basically every computer at MIT was accessible to the internet. So I set up my computer to hold an archive of every FAQ posting that I could find in every news group. And that way, when someone asked a question that was answered in the FAQ posting, instead of having to answer it yet again, I could post a link to the file on my server. Now, this was before the World Wide Web. So a link in this case meant either a file transfer protocol path, so you would have to use the FTP program to connect to the server to download it, or instructions for accessing the FAQ posting that I was referring the person to through a mail server that I wrote myself. So they could send an email message to the server and
This
it would send back the link.
is why I keep saying that we are the digital natives. We know how stuff works. We know how to do things. The younger generation are just really slick with, search engine terms and apps.
I mean, I'm
And
sure there are
props.
people who could do what I described, I'm sure. Anyway, that was the first incarnation of the FAQ server that I built and maintained. And the next step, of course, was I was copying all the FAQs from the internet onto my server by hand. So now I had to write something to automatically find the FAQ postings when they were posted in a Usenet news group and archive the current version on the server automatically. So that was step two. And then the third iteration of that was when we created a bunch of news groups whose purpose was to be the centralized location for all these FAQ postings. And then I no longer had to go searching all over Usenet to find the FAQs to put onto the server. I could just watch those specific news groups and take all of the postings in those news groups and save them onto the server. So the name of the server was rtfm.mit.edu. So that server still exists. I don't know what, I believe the URL still exists. I don't know what's running on it right now. It's no longer maintained by me for the last 30 plus years, but it's still there. So that's the origin story for that. So in terms of what happened after I left MIT, like I mentioned, while I was at MIT, I worked for the undergraduate computer system there. The guy who ran the undergraduate computer system there left MIT to start his own consulting company, and a couple of my friends and I, who all graduated at the same time, went and joined him, and we all did information security consulting and software for a few years, and that was kind of the kickstart of my career. So, I mean, I'm not going to walk you through 30 years of my career, but suffice it to say that as John mentioned, I've done a whole slew of things. I've done software engineering, I've done information security, I've done operations, I've done release engineering, I've done SRE, I've done DevOps, I've done DevSecOps. And most recently, the last 10 years or so, I've been doing full-time information security leadership, management and leadership. So because of my background as an engineer, right, I approach information security from a very engineering-focused perspective. Like, I'm not looking to check boxes on a compliance checklist. I'm looking to figure out what do you need to do from an engineering perspective to make something secure. And then once you've done that and you have something secure, you figure out how to check the right boxes to make the auditors happy. That's my approach to information security.
One of the things that I saw that you've said frequently since Doge came into your life was that they had a lot of trouble understanding why you worked for the government digital service because, they sort of, but you could be making so much more money in business.
I think that's true of pretty much everyone who was working at USDS when I joined it a couple years ago. Look, the reality is that I went to USDS because I wanted to serve the public. That's kind of the definition of public service, working for the government. And I mean, I'll be perfectly honest with you. I don't think the people who are running DOGE right now, or frankly, the people who are running the federal government right now, have any concept whatsoever of public service. I think they're in it for themselves. Yeah, I was asked that question the day after the inauguration. Every USDS employee was interviewed by someone from DOGE, And that was the last question they asked me, was why are you here when you could be making so much more money elsewhere? And I told them it's because I'm here to serve the public. I don't care about the money. I care about public service. And that was a place I landed, incrementally throughout my career. So I worked for a lot of startups in the Boston area primarily. I loved those jobs. They were fun. I loved the people that I got to work with. I loved a lot of what I worked on. But the reality is, what does a startup do? A startup is just trying to make some venture capitalists rich, right? That's what startups do. And I will tell you, around 2016, I came to realize that I wanted to do more with my skills than just make venture capitalists rich. And I had already, for many years, been doing all sorts of volunteer activities kind of in my spare time. So I would go to work and I would do my job, which was trying to make me and other people money. And then in my after hours, I would volunteer for my synagogue, I would volunteer for my kids' schools, I would volunteer for community organizations. So I was leading this split life. I was living the capitalist dream for half the time, and sort of living the activist dream that for half the time. And I don't know, capitalism lost a lot of its allure in 2016, and it hasn't really gained it back. So I came to the realization that I really wanted to find a way to do service, and the government was an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I think the U.S. government service was the U.S. digital service was kind of based on the similar thing in the U.K., the government digital service, which started here in 2010 or 2011, and that was the pitch that, I mean, the guys who were running it had worked for things like The Guardian. They had built various systems, to open platforms and things like that, and the pitch they made to a lot of the people that they tried to hire was, you come work for us and you can change the lives of tens of millions of people. And for a lot of people, that's a really great opportunity.
Yeah, and that's definitely, yes, it was based on the GDS in the UK. It was also, I mean, it arose out of the healthcare.gov debacle when they launched healthcare.gov, and the site fell down on its face on the first day. And I think the story was that like six people were able to register for health insurance on the first day, even though like millions of people were trying. I think it was something ridiculous like that. And that was when Obama was in office, of course, and he looked at that and he was like, this is. So first of all, he sort of drafted a tiger team of people to come in and fix it. Like, so the reason why healthcare.gov failed essentially is because it was kind of a classic government project, in the sense of there were multiple contractors who all had to collaborate with each other and with the government to make something happen. And they specified all of the requirements for the project upfront in this long, gargantuan contract with the contractor. And anytime anything had to change in the contract, they had to negotiate a change order with extra money for the contractor, and there was no flexibility, and there were no incremental deliverables, so the government couldn't make sure that things were on track. And they were just repeatedly asking throughout the project, asking the contractor, "Are things on track? Are things on track?" And the contractor was repeatedly insisting, "Yeah, everything's fine. It'll be ready on launch date, no problem." And they were lying. It wasn't. Everything was not fine, and it was not going to be ready on launch date. And then it launched, and it fell on its face. So two things happened after that. The first thing was, Obama told his chief of staff, who, by the way, tried to resign over it. Like, he went into Obama's office the next morning with a letter of resignation because of what had happened. And Obama, this is Dennis McDonough, who was subsequently the Secretary of Veterans Affairs while I was at the VA, a real mensch, a great guy. And Obama said, "I'm not letting you out of it that easy. You broke it. You're going to fix it." So he told Dennis McDonough to figure out how to fix the site. And so Dennis went off and he drafted all these hot shots from tech and brought them in, and they spent 3 months fixing everything that the contractor had gotten wrong, like just making the site work. And then they relaunched it like 3 months later, and it worked. And the people in the Obama administration figured out that there was an opportunity here to recognize that this was not a one-off. Like, this was not just healthcare.gov. This was the whole way that the government was building and maintaining technology that needed to change. And that was the birth of both 18F, which you've probably heard of because DOGE killed 18F, and the US Digital Service, which was unfortunately turned into DOGE by Trump on his inauguration.
So how did the digital service work in that? So you were working at VA. Were you working for sort of like as a contractor through the digital service, or did the digital service just place you there? How did that work?
So the digital service model before Trump came over and took over and destroyed it, but the USDS model was that there are basically three kinds of things that USDS worked on. So the first of those is a tiger team. Something is going wrong at an agency. We need to parachute in some USDS people to knock heads together with the authority of the White House behind them and fix it. Right. So that the most recent example of that is, frankly, the FAFSA, the Federal Application for First Financial Aid. FAFSA was completely messed up a year and a half ago, and USDS was dispatched into the Department of Education, along with, by the way, some incredible people from what the heck is the name of the company? The company that does the SATs. I'm blanking on their name right now. The College Board.
Educational Testing Service.
Right. So they sent some people in. They actually literally took sabbaticals from their jobs to come into the government and help get FAFSA to work, right? So that, and they were great people, and they did a great job working with the USDS people also. So that's an example of the tiger team. Like, there's a problem, we need to fix it. The second category is working on projects with agencies. So an agency wants to do something, they need some USDS help to get it done. Frequently, those projects involved collaboration between multiple agencies. So there's, and because that's always when it gets sticky. Right, because then there's power struggles and who's in charge and who's turf and who's going to write the APIs and who's going to decide what the standards are. So whenever agencies have to talk to each other, there can be political difficulties. So USDS would come in and kind of corral those and organize them and get people to talk to each other and get them to work together and make sure that the projects were successful. And then the third category is the category that I was in, which is basically, I would call it staff augmentation. USDS helps place people long term into other agencies to improve their ability to develop and maintain technology. So there is a digital service at the Department of Veterans Affairs, DSVA. And for ever since DSVA was founded, USDS has helped to staff up DSVA. So I was hired into USDS. I was officially a USDS employee. I was paid through the White House, but I was detailed for a year and a half to VA, and that was my full-time job for a year and a half. And I loved it there, and I would have been happy to stay and keep doing the work if circumstances had not changed.
Right, and when circumstances changed, it was that it Doge became a thing, and I'm a little curious, kind of as an outsider, I've been hearing these stories about Doge. I remember the day that we heard that they had got into the Treasury, and that they were mucking with Treasury systems and so forth. And it's like there seemed to be a lot of confusion about what exactly they were doing. Do you have a clearer perspective of exactly what Doge was up to? We know that they were like firing people and that they were getting access to data and so forth, but there's other things, rumors. Like, a good example of a rumor is the rumor that they were going to try to rewrite the Social Security payment system or something like that. Is Doge doing a bunch of different things, or are they just in doing investigatory stuff initially, or what was your perception?
All right, so Doge is trying to do three different things. I think it's important to lift this out of the weeds and to look high level at what the three things they're trying to do are. The first thing is grift, right? They're trying to steal money to benefit people like Elon Musk. Elon Musk wants to rig how contracts are awarded by the government so he and Donald Trump can control who gets the contracts. And guess what? Funnily enough, a lot of those contracts are coincidentally going to go to Elon Musk's companies and the companies of his friends, right? So that's number one. Number two is they are trying to destroy the government. I'm just going to be frank here. Like, I'm not going to beat around the bush. I'm not going to equivocate. What Trump and Project 2025 are trying to do is destroy the federal government. It was Grover Norquist who said many years ago that he wanted to shrink the government down to a size that was small enough that he could drown it in a bathtub. Like, these folks do not believe that there should be a federal government which constrains, rich white Christian men in any substantive way. And therefore, they are trying to destroy every aspect of the federal government which constrains them or their actions, which is most of the government. right? The whole, and then the third thing they're trying to do is they're trying to amass all of the data that the federal government has on Americans in one place so that they can use it to create a police state. Like every police state in history has kept dossiers on its citizens as a standard operating procedure. And the United States government has more data on its citizens, I would argue, than any other government in history. And before Trump came along, it was siloed in different agencies, and there's laws that require it to be siloed in those agencies. The Privacy Act, for example, requires that siloing, and there's a reason for it. And the reason for it is exactly to prevent what Trump and Musk want to do, which is to use that data to go after Americans who are enemies of the administration. So those are the three things that DOGE is trying to do. Anything that they tell you about efficiency or cutting waste and fraud and abuse, those are all lies. That is not what they are trying to do. They are trying to commit grift, they are trying to destroy the government, and they are trying to amass data in a centralized location so that they can use it to go after people.
Well,
That's it.
one of the frightening things I just read today is the Elon's doggies. I don't ever call them Doge. I mean, they are doggies that are on his leash. They are in the Department of Governmental Efficiency, but they are in DHS now. They have taken over the Office of Biometric Identity Management. And that is a rather frightening thing because that's a very little known organization. But biometrics are the key to a lot of secure systems. And if they get that, then they pretty much have the keys to the cap to the kingdom.
I mean, I think they already pretty much have the keys to the kingdom, right? Because most of the efforts to stop them from gaining access to whatever data they wanted to gain access to have not been successful. There have been a few successes. The courts have been able to constrain some of what they have been doing, but more successes than failures in terms of what they've DOGE has had more success than failure in terms of getting to the data that they want to get to. So I'm definitely, I mean, there was also over at over at GSA, Thomas Shedd, the guy who runs GSA, was talking about changing how login.gov works to make login.gov integrate with like social security data so that they could verify people's identities by having login.gov talk directly to the social security databases. And that's a terrible idea. And I mean, we could go into why it's a terrible idea, but it's a terrible idea. But that's they all of these rules about segmenting data so that it can't be abused, they just don't care. Like the rules are meaningless to them. And so, and like I said, so far they've been mostly successful at breaking down those walls, which is extraordinarily worrisome.
The thing that the thing I found most scary actually was not the biometrics, but the fact that they revoked I forget how many hundred social security numbers it was, basically turning somebody over in a second into a non-person.
Yep. It's not that they revoked the social security numbers, they put them in the master death file.
Right. They put them in the data.
So that's never been used for that purpose before. And if someone is marked as dead in the master death file, they can't get a driver's license, they can't get a bank account, they can't get a credit card, they can't pay taxes, right? Even if it, keep in mind, you have to keep in mind that there are, if you are a legal immigrant to this country, you can get a social security number. If you're not a citizen, you can get a social security number. You can use that social security number to pay taxes, but you cannot collect social security when you retire because you're not a citizen. Only citizens are eligible to collect social security. So we're talking about them quite possibly and making legal, not even undocumented immigrants, but legal documented immigrants and turning them into non-people, making it impossible for them to live in this country. And they're just getting started. Like they're going to get away with whatever they can get away with. So they're going to increase that. They're going to make it harder for immigrants to live in this country. Again, even legal immigrants. Like Trump and Musk and Kristi Noem, they don't care about legal versus illegal, or certainly not Stephen Miller. As far as they're concerned, if you are not an American citizen, and maybe in some cases if you are an American citizen, but certainly if you are not an American citizen, they want you out of this country. And they're going to do whatever they can to get those people out of this country. And that's extraordinarily alarming and disturbing.
Yeah, and question is whether this is just practice for things they might do to people who are not immigrants or non-citizens, but to actual citizens at some point.
I think that's true, yes.
Now I'm really nervous.
I mean, I don't bring good cheer and unicorns and rainbows usually when I appear on these podcasts, because I am not optimistic right now about what's happening in the country.
Well, that raises a good question. Can you think of anything that you are optimistic about?
So I think what Trump is doing with the tariffs is an incredible blunder. And because it is going to hit pretty much every American in the pocketbook very soon now, and he can't undo it quickly. So when Trump declared those tariffs and all of a sudden shipping from China went to almost zero, right? And by the way, it's not actually at zero, but it is much lower than it was before. It causes a ripple effect through the supply chain, just like during COVID when there was a supply chain impact, which takes a substantial amount of time to undo. So even if Trump turned around tomorrow and canceled all the tariffs, what he has already done to the supply chain is still going to be felt all over the country by everyone. Red states, blue states, Democrats, Republicans, rich people, poor people, everyone is going to feel it. And he can't stop it. And therefore, people already don't like him. His approval rating went down to like 39% last week. It's going to go lower than that, which is astounding, because 39% is basically the lowest approval rating that any president has ever had since they started tracking approval ratings, right? So unfortunately, I hate to say it, but unfortunately, what wakes people up in this country and makes them mad and gets them out into the streets is when it, like money, like when it's hitting them in the pocketbook. So the one thing I'm optimistic about is that I think the tariffs were an incredible mistake, and I think they are going to rebound extraordinarily damagingly on not just Trump, but on the Republican members of Congress who are enabling him. And I don't know if this is going to happen, but my pie in the sky hope is that there are enough Republicans in Congress who are feeling threatened enough by their constituents over what Trump is doing that they start opposing what he is doing more aggressively. And it doesn't take that many. It only takes like a handful of Republicans in the House and like two Republicans in the Senate, maybe three for margin of error, right? For Congress to stop voting for anything that he wants. And in fact, to vote against the things that he wants, right? So that short term, what I am optimistic about is that the tariffs were a mistake and that they might cause enough blowback for him that it will significantly hamper his progress towards fascism, is how I would best describe it. I believe that Donald Trump's goal in this country is to turn this country into an authoritarian fascist state. That is what he wants to do. Like, unequivocally, that is what he wants to do. So the only question is whether enough of the population rises up quickly enough to prevent that from happening. That is the only question I see at this time. And the only thing that I have seen that has the potential to cause that to happen is the tariffs and the blowback from the tariffs.
Yeah, I live in a very conservative county in Texas, and they were voted, you know, resoundingly for Trump in the recent election. And I've gone out to the grocery store the other day, and these people are just piling in all the things that they can possibly buy in groceries and in places like Walmart. They're just wildly buying. And I asked a few people, they said, well, we don't know if we're going to have these things in a few weeks because of the tariffs. And these are pretty conservative, older people, and they're frightened. And it reminds me a lot of the gas crisis back in the early 70s, when people were going and stockpiling gasoline because they didn't know if they would ever have any. So it seems like people are beginning to panic, realizing that this tariff thing is not a great thing.
Absolutely. But I think it's even one step further than that. Look, when people go to buy their kids Christmas presents and there are no toys on the shelves, I don't know, are we allowed to swear on this podcast? That's when the shit is going to hit the fan, right? That when people, and you've heard what Trump has been saying the last couple of weeks when he's been asked about stuff like that, that, oh, you know, a child doesn't need 30 dolls. They can only have 2 dolls. Like, it's disgusting. Like the things he's been saying are disgusting, right? And you know, I look, it's frankly, it's a faint hope. Right, because I think what we've seen is that Trump's base is going to cling to him no matter what, right? But so he's always going to have, like, frankly, 30% of the country that is going to support him no matter what, right? So, but the question is whether the people that are kind of insultingly referred to sometimes as low information voters, the people who are not following along obsessively on Mastodon every day, you know, on the news or on Twitter or whatever. The question is if what's happening right now with the tariffs and with the supply chain disruptions is going to wake them enough to get them to realize that this guy is serious and that they need to do something about it. And I'm, you know, you asked what I'm optimistic about. That's pretty much it right now, the possibility that that might happen.
I have one other question, which is about, well, so this morning we were reading that Anonymous hacked this Global X airline that was carrying the deportation flights and got all of the information about those flights. And we know that Anonymous has done things like that. I'm just kind of wondering, for people who are deeply immersed in technology and really understand technology, is that something that we should expect to see more of? Is part of the resistance to what's happening, is it going to be coming from people who understand technology? Do you think that technologists, people who have worked in technology for years, are in a position to take some action and are inclined to, you know, that sort of thing?
I mean, look, I've never been a part of that world, so I'm not going to claim to have firsthand knowledge of the hacktivist community. What I can tell you is this: we certainly saw that surrounding the war in Ukraine. We saw people hacking Russian websites at every opportunity and hacking Russian TV stations and doing, you know, broadcasting pirate TV signals on top of Russian TV stations and things like that. Are we going to see that more in the U.S.? Well, I mean, we have been seeing it in the United States, right? There wasn't just that hack. Of Global X. There was also did you know this company, this telemessage company that made the bogus signal clone that Mike Waltz was using, like within days of when that news broke in 404 Media, someone had hacked telemessage and forced them to cease operations, at least temporarily, right? Because their security was so ridiculously bad that this hacker was able to hack their app in like 15 minutes. Right. I mean, and that, keep in mind, this is the National Security Advisor using an app that some random anonymous hacker was able to break into and steal data from in 15 minutes. This, boys and girls, is why there are rules about what technology is used to handle classified information. Right. That so it absolutely is already happening. And there was also, you remember when Doge put up that, the website claiming to show, you know, the money they'd saved. And within days of when that happened, someone had figured out that there was an open database on the internet that anybody could post content into that website through. Right. So, you know, we're at a lot of the people who are opposing what's happening in the administration right now have a lot of disadvantages. But one advantage we have is that a lot of the people who are doing this stuff, they're just clowns. Like, they're dumb. And they're not good at what they're doing, which means they're leaving all of these openings that we can drive a semi truck through and take advantage of their incompetence. So do I think we will see more of that? I absolutely hope so. And I think there's a pretty good chance because I think they've established a track record of having pretty bad OPSEC. And I think there are definitely people who are going to be willing to take advantage of that.
That raises a question about Elon Musk, you know, supposedly a genius. You know, you hear that often, that he's characterized as a genius. But some of the things that he's done with Doge and with X and so forth have not seemed like genius moves. So I wonder about that whole Doge Drew, I know he's got a number of people in Doge, and some of them have taken positions in government, similar to you taking the position at VA. He's been moving some of his people into government through what is now USDS/Doge. But how smart are they?
So the we used to call them at USDS, we call them the muskrats, not the doggies. The muskrats are they're all. You know what? How smart they are is not the question. The question is how wise they are, right? How much experience do they have? So one of the hallmarks of USDS was that I didn't get hired into USDS until I'd been doing tech for more than 30 years. Like, if you don't have a minimum of like 10 years of experience in tech, USDS probably isn't even going to look at you, right? Because the way you learn how to do tech securely and safely and scalably is by doing it. And you know what? The first couple of years you're doing it, you're usually not that good at it, right? You have to gain wisdom and experience before you're good at it. So these kids that Elon Musk brought in to deploy into these agencies, they're not that good at it. They may be really smart, but they're not that good at it. They're like that smart ass kid I was when I got to MIT at 17, who thought I was, you know, the hottest shit, who knew everything, and learned very quickly that I was not, that there were many, I would argue most people at MIT that were smarter than I was. Now, Trump and Musk have absolutely zero respect for any of the people who were working for the federal government before they showed up. Like, they don't believe these people are smart. They don't believe these people have wisdom. They don't believe these people have experience. They have no, Trump is like a huge believer in the cult of the engineer. The only people who matter are the engineers. Nobody else matters. And, you know, all you have to do is be hardcore and work 80-hour weeks and sleep on the floor in your office and you will be able to accomplish anything.
Well, but the other thing is that these are, you know, they hang around all the time with people who say that government is crap and nobody who's any good would work there.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. So that's what they've
come to believe their own Kool-Aid, so to speak.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So their perception is that these 20-year-olds or 21-year-olds can come in and they will be smarter and more talented and they can just use AI and rewrite everything that needs to be written and fix all the problems in government. And, you know, what was it? Was it Scoop that mentioned, or I can't remember, Scoop or John, that mentioned that they talked about rewriting the entire Social Security code base and converting it from COBOL into Java in like 3 months. And every single person who has ever worked with either Java or COBOL or AI or government scale projects looked at that and said, these people are certifiably insane. Like, there is no planet on which you can rewrite 40 million lines of COBOL code that are load-bearing in 3 months in Java and expect that to do anything but crash and burn forever.
Like, yeah, in 2017, they were attempting a modernization project, and I think it collapsed.
Multiple
they couldn't
modernization
make
projects
it work,
collapsed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I'm not... So I read a very interesting article about that specific thing, about the whole, let's rewrite the whole Social Security system from COBOL into Java. And it explained that one of the reasons why COBOL is the language in which that system is still built is because COBOL does things that Java does not do in a way that Java does not do them. Like, the COBOL programming language is built for the kind of use case that the Social Security Administration and the IRS have. So for someone to come in and say, well, we should rewrite it in Java, it suggests that they don't actually understand what they are dealing with. And I think that is true in general of Elon Musk and the Muskrats. They don't actually understand what they are dealing with. Now, to some extent, they don't care because, like I said, their goal is destruction. But to the extent that they actually do want to persevere things, or persist things, I should say, they're not good at it. And so I fully expect things to go very wrong in any of the areas in which they try to do major upgrades to any system within the government.
This is part of the computer industry in general, is this idea that if it's new, it must be better. And then every time you encounter a problem, it's a problem no one has ever encountered before. So there's no value in going and looking up historical solutions to it.
I mean, I would correct that slightly. I wouldn't say that is part of the tech industry in general. I would say that is the Silicon Valley mindset, right?
Fair enough.
So I like I said, I've spent my entire career working for Boston startups. And, you know, some of the companies that I work for have been headquartered out in California, but most of them have been headquartered in this area. And the Boston startup mindset is not the same as the Silicon Valley mindset. It's a different mindset. It's one of the reasons I love living in Boston and working in Boston, because there is a more down-to-earth attitude about stuff like this. Having said that, I'm not... Look, how do I want to say this? There are... If you ask anyone who works for the Social Security Administration or the IRS in their technology areas, you know, are there things that we need to replace or rewrite within our infrastructure? They will say, absolutely, there are hundreds of things that need to be replaced and rewritten. No one is denying that there are things that are too old and rickety that need to be fixed within these computer systems, right? And like John said, they tried and failed, right? They tried and failed. And part of the reason they failed, I suspect, is because they tried to do too much, right? So one of the main USDS challenges that they faced many times over the year, I should say, not they faced, they did face before Trump axed them, but one of the main USDS challenges was, in fact, technology transformation and modernization. Like, they were often called upon to do modernization projects. So the first question you have to answer when you're doing a modernization project is, are you doing a drop-in replacement for the entire system that you're trying to modernize, or are you going to incrementally replace pieces of it, right? And I believe the one of the modernization projects that failed, they actually tried to replace everything, and that was never going to work. So if they want to modernize the Social Security Administration, and by the way, I should mention that before Trump was inaugurated, USDS was embedded in the Social Security Administration, and they were working on modernization efforts. So that was already happening at the Social Security Administration incrementally, which is the only way it could possibly succeed. And then Trump and Musk came in and fired all the USDSers, right? So this is yet another example of, if they really were about government efficiency and modernization, they would not have fired 18F and USDS. They would have grown 18F and USDS and brought in more of the same kinds of people to do the same kind of work. But that is not what they did, because that is not what their goal is, right? I was just talking to a friend yesterday who I talk to occasionally about like my outlook for the world and what I think is coming. And I told him flat out, I will be pleasantly surprised if there is still a Social Security to send me checks in 10 years when I retire, but I don't expect that to happen. I think the damage that Musk is doing to Social Security is so horrific that I do not think the agency is going to survive. So I'm not putting it beyond the realm of possibility that we will pull out of this tailspin and, you know, put the right guardrails back in place so that SSA is still around and then people still get their Social Security checks. But I think right now, more likely than not, Social Security Administration is dead or on its last legs. And there will be no checks for me, you know, when I hit 65 and I'm legally allowed to start collecting Social Security. Or whatever it is, 67 and a half, or whatever the age is. I don't think they're actually out to, if, let me put it this way. If they actually were going to try to rewrite the whole thing in Java in 3 months, then the reason they would do that is because they were trying to make it fail.
I experienced that kind of project back when I was working in the Bay Area for Kaiser Permanente's IT group. And this is when consulting companies like Anderson and Deloitte were really moving into all sorts of businesses. And they showed up with busloads of freshly graduated, you know, fresh-faced young kids who had no work experience, and expecting them to redesign our medical billing systems and our medical, you know, record keeping. And it was just a nightmare, because they had all these great ideas that were based on things that had no relationship to what we were doing. So I can see how that kind of thing was probably really impressive to someone like Musk, you know, seeing how all these people can go in and just take over companies. And that's basically what they did.
The consulting industry in this country is problematic. Let me put it that way. I know I'm hyping USDS a lot in this conversation, but I will say that another kind of revolution that USDS helped bring into the government, and they certainly weren't the only ones, but they had a lot to do with it, was restructuring how the government signs technology contracts so that the government can exercise effective oversight over the contracts while the work is being done. So this idea of, with tech projects, of writing a contract at the beginning of the project, which specifies all of the requirements for the project, and then the contractor just goes off and builds what it says at the contract that they're supposed to build, and then comes back in a year or 2 years or 3 years or whatever and says, here it is, it's done, and hands it over, right? That's that. No one in private industry builds software like that anymore. That's ridiculous. It doesn't work.
The repeated failure of very large public IT projects was the proximate cause of setting up GDS in the UK.
Yep.
That and the fact that when the conservative/liberal Democrat government took over in 2010, they found a note from the Treasury Secretary that said, there's no money, bye. So,
well, part of the problem here is that you have business people who are convinced that they can make government better or more efficient because they don't understand government. They understand business. And governments don't run the same way that businesses do. And I worked for the government for years and worked with government technology. And I remember a team of guys who came in who were supposed to rewrite the code for a particular application that we had running. And when they showed up at the door, they had big grins on their faces and were just happy as a clam with, you know, we're going to come in and we're going to fix your problem, you know, your inefficient program. And the longer they worked on it, the more those smiles turned upside down. They started frowning a lot because they started to realize that one of the reasons that there was an apparent inefficiency is because we had to serve various laws and regulations that were sometimes not fitting very well together. And you know, there are inefficiencies in government that are partly a result of the way legislation is created and the way regulations are created and all of the interests that have to be served in creating those things. And you have a complexity that doesn't exist in business where you may just have this top-down thing where you have a guy at the top and he's the boss and he tells everybody what to do. That doesn't happen in government. I was trying to explain that to a guy the other day who was complaining about bureaucracy, and he was describing bureaucracies as though they were all top-down, but that's never been my experience. My experience is that they're very distributed and that you have a lot of stakeholders and you have to get them all at the table in order to figure anything out. Yep. It's a real different environment.
One of the things that the first administrator of USDS, Mikey Dickerson, pointed out after we saw Trump starting to do what Trump and Doge, was so there's this concept that you hear about when you join USDS. They call it air cover, and the other thing they call it is sometimes they call it a shit umbrella, in the sense of the job of leadership. The job of leadership is to protect the people doing the work from people who are trying to derail them and shit on them, right? Doge has perfect air cover, right? Trump is letting Musk do whatever he wants to do. And, you know, doesn't care about the law, doesn't care about the regulations, doesn't care about the rules. He can just do whatever he wants to do. And if people want to sue us about it, then they'll sue us about it. And if we lose the lawsuits, maybe we'll listen to the courts and maybe we won't. Like that is like perfect air cover, right? So one of the things Mikey said was he hopes that if we ever pull out of this tailspin and we, you know, we save our democracy and we are back in a country where the government is being run by same people, one of the lessons they should take away from everything we've seen happen for the last 109 days or whatever it's been is actually USDS could have accomplished a lot more if they had had a little bit better air cover. Not DOGE level air cover, but certainly not the air cover that they were given for the 10 years that they existed. Because every once in a while, the White House would decide that something was a high enough priority that USGS was just going to be sent in to get it done, and whatever they asked for, they got. That did happen a few times over the course of the 10 years that USGS existed. But a lot of the time, USGS could not get done what it wanted to get done because of exactly what John was describing, because you have to get all the stakeholders to agree. And if you're dealing with multiple agencies, they all have to agree to work with each other. And unless, you know, the president of the United States picks up the phone and calls the secretary and the undersecretary of all the agencies involved and says, get the hell out of their way and let them do what they're trying to do, because that is what I want, it's often not possible to accomplish everything that you want to accomplish. So
is the thing of being able to file taxes for free? Was that one of those things? Because I know that for years and years, it was, you know, people kept getting stuck with Intuit and various other bits of paid software. And I know that was something that took a long time to come up with. And now I think Trump is canceling it.
So I'll tell you. So USGS had a foray into the IRS earlier to try to do some work with the IRS, which did not go well. And I don't remember what the project was or what the details were, but it did not go well. And USGS was kind of asked to leave the agency and did not do any further work with the IRS for a while. And I don't know exactly what motivated the return, the re-examination of the idea of direct file, and what motivated them to pull USGS back in for that. I suspect it was some politicking. I suspect the USGS leadership probably, talked to the right people and, you know, made the right apologies and concessions and sort of repaired that relationship. So when Congress passed the funding for what they called a direct file pilot project, right? That's not even correct. Let me correct myself. What Congress called for was a feasibility study. Congress allocated money to allow the IRS to do a feasibility study of whether it was feasible for them to build technology to allow people to file their taxes directly. So the IRS came to USGS and said, can you help us figure out how to do this? And the USGS answer, which is a common strategy that USGS has used throughout the years, is that their feasibility study was a pilot, as in, we are going to find out whether it is possible to do it by doing it. And either we will succeed or we will fail. So that was not the current tax year, but the previous tax year, USGS, working with some folks at IRS, built the first iteration of direct file, which was a small number of states, right? The second year, the number of people involved expanded. There were more USGS people, some 18F people were pulled in, and more IRS people were pulled in, and they expanded the effort to encompass a much larger number of states where you could use direct file. So that was a joint effort of IRS, 18F, and USGS. And you are correct. Now, of course, Trump is killing it because it is a service which benefits the American taxpayer, and therefore, why would he leave it running?
I heard that within the last week or so that Elon Musk has decided not to continue doing government work. I assume because his people at Tesla are threatening to kick him out if he doesn't pay more attention to Tesla. But if Elon Musk leaves DOGE, what happens with DOGE?
All right. So there's a lot to unpack there. So first of all, Elon Musk was brought into the government as a special government employee, and that is term limited. And I believe his term ends at the end of May. So he's not allowed to continue working for the government past the end of May. And if he does, he has to give up all of his other jobs. That's the law. Now, obviously, the Trump administration has not been particularly constrained by the law up until this point, but apparently they feel constrained by this one. So the reason why Musk is putting on a show of leaving is because, legally speaking, he has to leave by the end of May. I think May 20th. So that's point number one. Point number two, I don't think he's actually going to relinquish any control, even if he appears to leave DC and go back to Starlink or SpaceX or Tesla or whatever. I think he is going to continue to pull strings behind the scenes. I think he is going to continue to be the guy in charge of DOGE who is running things. Right. That is my opinion. So it's all a show, I think. Point number three is I don't care whether he's still working for Doge. The reason why the Tesla takedown protests and all that other stuff are trying to destroy his value is because they perceive that as the only way that they can reduce the amount of power that he has over the American people. And I think that is correct. So I think that even if he steps down as CEO, even if he steps down from Doge, I think those protests will still continue, and rightfully so. Finally, point number four, if Musk really does back away, if I am wrong, which I concede the possibility of, it's just going to be Russell Vought's just going to take over. And Russell Vought is even worse than Musk. He is more evil than Musk, and he is smarter than Musk. And Russell Vought is not doing what he's doing because he has this fantasy about a colony on Mars, which is why Musk is doing what he's doing. Russell Vought is doing what he's doing because he believes 100% in the Project 2025 project, like the mission of Project 2025. So I don't think it will be a good thing if Elon Musk leaves and goes back to Tesla. I think it will, if he actually does, because I think it will be worse, because I think Russell Vought will be better at what Musk has been doing. And frankly, there are people who say, and I do not know whether this is true, there are people who say that it's actually been Russell Vought who's been calling the shots all along. Right, that everything that's been going on has been Musk is just the front for it, but the beard, but the real bad actor within the administration who is doing all of this stuff is Russell Vought. And that is entirely plausible because he wrote much of Project 2025, and he's the guy who stood up in a private speech before the inauguration and said that he wanted to make federal employees traumatized coming to work every day, and that's what we are seeing happen. So it's not gonna change anything in practically speaking, in terms of how bad things are if Musk backs down and goes back to playing with his rockets and his cars. It's just not going to make a difference.
Thinking about Project 2025, Doge has been cutting a lot of staff. They've been firing people right and left. And my recollection of Project 2025 was not that they were just going to get rid of a bunch of people, but they were going to get rid of them, yes, but they were going to replace them with loyalists of whatever kind. So I wonder if that's in the cards, that all of these jobs that are getting cut are going to be filled, but they're going to be filled with people who have one way or another signed a loyalty oath.
So it is my understanding that new government hires at this point are in fact being vetted for loyalty to the administration. That is happening already. You cannot get hired into the federal government right now unless you have been vetted successfully. The rumor, which I have yet to see any proof of, but the rumor I heard from a well-placed source is that literally the Heritage Foundation is vetting new government employees before they get hired to find out if they are sufficiently loyal to the administration. Do I think that they're going to replace all of the people that they're firing with loyalists? No, I do not, because as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, I think that their goal is to kill a bunch of these agencies entirely. Project 2025 wants to shut down the Department of Education. It just wants it to be gone, right? So they're not going to refill all of the headcount that they've axed at the Department of Education, because their goal is to wind it down and shut it down, right? So, but yes, where they are hiring people, they are hiring loyalists 100%.
The loyalty oath thing didn't really apply to the doggies of Elon, because they didn't have a background check, or they didn't have to do drug testing or anything. And that seems to be at odds with the, and I wonder if they had a loyalty test.
I mean, you're talking about the background checks and the drug tests that federal employees usually go through before they're allowed to access sensitive systems and sensitive data. That's about their loyalty to the Constitution and to the serving the American people. And by the way, every federal employee, when they become a federal employee, have to take essentially the same oath that the president takes, right? It doesn't say the office of president, right? It's slightly different words, but it's every federal employee has to take an oath swearing that they will, uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Like, that is part of the oath you take to be a federal employee, right? None of the Muskrats were required to take that oath, because none of them are actually real federal employees. They're all special federal employees that are working for a temporary organization ostensibly without pay, although I'm sure they are getting paid under the table by Musk or the Heritage Foundation or somebody. So they did not take an oath, and they also did not undergo background checks or drug tests, which I had to do before I went to work for the government. But they are certainly loyal, right? I've seen no evidence that Big Balls is not loyal to Trump and Musk, right? They were brought in because of their loyalty, I'm sure. So the kind of loyalty test they went through was not a test of their loyalty to the American people. It was a test of their loyalty to Elon Musk, which clearly they have passed so far because they are willing to do all of the things that they are doing. And despite the fact that they are breaking laws left and right and breaking regulations left and right and hurting real people every single day.
I mean, imagine being the kind of person whose idea of a good time at work is making everyone around you traumatized. I mean, that.
I mean, welcome to fascism.
Yeah.
Right?
Hey, I hate to bring this up, but we have reached the end of the hour. I kind of hate to stop right now. On the other hand, I may be a little more depressed than I was when we started talking.
Reality is depressing sometimes.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
It has been a blast. It really has. And we're serious. We would like for you to come back sometime because this has been fun.
Well, give me some time to recover and then we can do it again.
I mean, it's been frightening.
Here, I thought we were so nice to you.
We try to be gentle. Okay. Thank you. We'll see you later.
Thanks. Yep.
Adios.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.